It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we learn about an archaeological discovery that a human ancestor may have buried its dead, and we'll hear about it from one of the UW researchers uncovering the ancient remains. But first, a tourist at Yellowstone National Park made national news last month after attempting to help a baby bison out of the river. The bison was abandoned by its herd and ultimately had to be euthanized by park staff. The tourist was charged with a misdemeanor, and the story has served as a warning about the risks of interfering with wildlife, even when we have the best intentions. But now that it's summer and we're spending more time outdoors, it's likely that some of us will come across some wild animals who look like they may need help. Our guests today are here to tell us when to step in, when to get help, and when to leave it alone. Do you have a story about finding a wild animal in trouble? What did you do about it? What was the ultimate outcome? Do you have a story of good intentions gone wrong involving a wild animal? Join our conversation this afternoon at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can always post on our Ideas Network Facebook page as well. Our guest, Mandy Camps, who is a wildlife health conservation specialist for the Wisconsin DNR. And Mandy, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me today.
And also joining us, Taylor Siskin, who is an assistant captive wildlife and wildlife rehabilitation specialist for the DNR. Taylor, welcome to you.
Yeah, thank you. Great to be here.
Taylor, can we start with just a little bit of what your work looks like on a day-to-day basis at the Department of Natural Resources? What's your role? What do you do?
Sure. Yeah, I guess it depends day to day, time of the year. But on any given day, I might be, mainly helping to assist our wildlife rehabilitation program. So helping with licenses and exams and whatnot, and also helping with the Keep Wildlife Wild program and its poster contest. I also take a variety of calls from the public about anything that they might be finding. So really a variety. And like I said, kind of depends on the season.
Sure. And as we're getting into the summer season, what does that mean for you, Taylor?
Definitely lots of baby animal calls. So that is what's happening right now.
One of our producers, Colleen, had a roommate who just had rescued some ducklings from a storm sewer yesterday. So we'll get to that. But also, Mandy, I want to hear about your work and your role as a wildlife health conservation specialist for our DNR.
Yes, some of the main work that I do is I'm a primary contact for wildlife rehabilitation. Taylor and I work together very closely. I'm a contact for the licensed wildlife rehabilitators in the state and also a contact for the public who may have some questions or even are interested in the license. I also do a lot of public outreach on anything related to Keep Wildlife Wild. I give a lot of information about explaining animal natural behaviors, when an animal may or may not need help, and what to best do to help the animal, and then also have some questions pertaining to more of the captive wildlife situations.
Interesting. So, Mandy, what are the most common kind of calls you get from people who are concerned about a wild animal this time of year?
Well, this time of year, as Taylor said, too, a lot of baby animal calls. As people are outside more, the weather is nicer. It's the time of year when baby animals are here. So those reasons kind of lead to the interactions between people and animals increasing a bit more. And a lot of the questions that we get are folks that are outside enjoying the weather and come across an animal, especially a young one, and they're wondering if it is abandoned or if it needs help. And a lot of the natural behaviors of our wildlife species, the mothers or the parents will leave their young animals alone for extended periods of time during the day. That's really normal. That's the best thing that they can do to protect their young. But we get a lot of questions because some of that information isn't known by everybody. And so everyone has questions wondering if those animals need help.
Those ducklings in the storm sewer that our producer's roommate came across yesterday, mm-hmm. Taylor, is that a time to step in, or are those? I'd be curious to know, because all of a sudden my human reaction would be save the ducklings, but maybe that's doing more harm than good.
Well, in a case like that, a duckling definitely won't be able to fly itself or climb itself out. So in that would definitely be a case where you could reach out to some of your, local officials or local police department or fire department, I should say, and see if they can assist in that case. Because you always want to keep, human safety in mind, as well as a lot of the time those will be long roads or busy areas. So most of the time you're going to want to make sure that, like I said, human safety is checked off the list, and then see what you can do to get them out of that situation. And hopefully mom will be around or in the area, and much of the time she might be waiting for him, and sometimes that's how people might spot them.
So if we see a baby animal who has been left alone, I would imagine that our best bet, if it's not in something like a storm drain, would be to leave it be.
Yeah, that's really the best advice, is to, if you come across an animal, you're really not sure if it needs help or not, the best thing to do, make some observations, take some notes or even some pictures about what you're seeing, and then make some phone calls. Could be to your local DNR wildlife contacts or some other staff that you know locally where you are. There's a lot of wildlife rehabilitators across the state that have good information on their websites. You can call them as well. Some other facilities, like maybe some humane societies or other nature centers or rescue groups in the area, could help give you some information about if an animal does need help or what those normal behaviors are. But really, when it comes down to it, the best thing you can do is leave the animal where it is, and then make those calls, and then try and figure out if that animal does need help. If it does, we can certainly get that information too about how to help the animal appropriately.
Yeah, reach out to the specialists, reach out to the experts. And in fact, we have a link to the Wildlife Rehabilitation Resources and Directory from our DNR online now at WPR.org Central Time. So if you find yourself faced with some babies who seem to be in need, before you begin to reach out to the babies themselves, perhaps reach out to the experts first. And again, the Wildlife Rehabilitation Resources and Directory webpage from the DNR can be found quickly from WPR.org/Central Time. Our guests, Mandy Camps and Taylor Siskin from our DNR, we're taking a look at what to do when we come across wild animals who may seem like they are in need. And we're taking your stories as well at 1-800-642-1234, where Carrie joins us from Turtle Lake. Carrie, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. I sure appreciate what you ladies do for a living. On Friday, I was putting my pontoon boat into the water, and when I was unwrapping it, I saw a robin's nest on one of the hulls full of baby birds, baby robins. So we kind of didn't know what to do with it. Obviously, we had to move it, otherwise they would drown. So what would have been the best for those baby birds so they would have lived?
How can we, what would you have done with that nest, and who would like to take that?
Sure, I can take this question. So that happens often, especially in the spring, if you're taking some boats or campers out of storage. Earlier in the spring, you might come across like a squirrel nest or raccoons even, and sometimes songbird nests. So we do get this question often, and if you do find a nest like that, if there are some young nestlings in it, and if there is a spot close by, like a nearby tree or a shrub or something else that's not too far away, you can actually move that entire nest. You can take it off the boat where it is, put it into, well, if it's still intact, you can put it directly right on a tree branch, or if you need to, you can make a kind of a makeshift nest bowl. If you have an old Tupperware container, put some holes in the bottom for drainage, put the nest material and the nestlings in it, and then secure it the best you can to that tree or shrub nearby. And as long as it's still close by, the parents are still there, they still hear those nestlings, and they'll still be able to care for them.
Is there truth to the idea that if you touch a baby animal, it might be rejected by its parents?
Great question. No, that's really a myth. And of course, we want to try and limit the amount of interaction we have with animals, but if you do have to handle them just temporarily to move them to a safer place or whatever it may be, that is okay. Of course, we also always recommend wearing some gloves or putting a towel in between or a blanket or something like that. Always good safety measures for both you and the animal.
Taylor, my parents have, for some reason, birds that always want to build nests above their front door. And my parents, being who they are, end up spending a lot of times in the spring and early summer going in and out through their garage. Is there something that can be done to, before a nest gets done, perhaps find a way to suggest a better place for these birds to find a good nest?
Sure. I mean, yeah, I know sometimes they can find an interesting place to build their nest. Of course, they can also be very quick at building their nest. So, you know, sometimes it can be hard if they build them even in a day. You might not get the chance to kind of encourage them to move off somewhere else. You know, of course, if the more activity in the area, the less likely they're going to be to try and build there. Of course, sometimes you might even find a bird nest somewhere where there is a lot of activity. But, you know, whatever, you know, someone can do to kind of keep the area, you know, even just noise, you know, like I said, increased activity. Most, you know, animals like that are going to want a spot that's really quiet and peaceful. So, you know, right off the bat, that's something you can do. Mandy, I don't know if you have any other good suggestions for me here.
Well, I was just going to say that my mom was reluctant to bang on pats and pans at her front door, who were concerned about what her neighbors might think.
Yeah, certainly. That might be a little much, but for birds. But no, that's some good advice too. I mean, generally animals don't like to have in areas with a lot of activity, but if it's in like on top of a gutter or downspout or a doorway, if there's something you can do to block that area so they can't actually access it anymore, you can completely prevent them from even trying to build there in the first place. And then, of course, if you have a yard that has really good habitat, if you have trees, shrubs, other more natural places for them to nest, hopefully you're encouraging them to move to those places instead.
That's Mandy Camps, also joining us, Taylor Siskin from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And we're talking about what to do if we come across a wild animal that may need help. And we're taking your calls as well at 1-800-642-1234. Tell us about a time you came across wildlife in trouble. And have you found wild animals in places where they shouldn't be, like, you know, above your front door or perhaps even in your pet's mouth? 1-800-642-1234 for your questions and experiences. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our conversation continues next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation with Mandy Camps and Taylor Siskin, two wildlife experts from the Wisconsin DNR, and we're talking to them about what to do if you come across a wild animal that looks like it may need help. Where can you go to find the help that a wild animal may need to get it? And you can join our conversation. What questions do you have about wildlife rescue and rehabilitation? Is there a situation you commonly encounter that you don't know quite how to handle? And have you been in a situation before where you successfully helped an animal out? Share your stories. 1-800-642-1234. Post up on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to Nancy and Warren's next. Nancy, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, cool. I love listening to public radio. This is so cool.
Thanks for calling.
When my daughter lived in downtown Warrens, and I mean, like, if anybody's been there for Cranfest, like, right across from the school, the house next door had a fawn right in the bushes. Like, and it was there, like, in the early afternoon. And we called the wildlife thing, and they told us just to leave it alone. And the next morning, it was gone. It was, like, really cool that, yeah, like, the mom came and rescued it.
Yeah. Yeah, I thank you for the story, because that's kind of what I believe, Mandy and Taylor, that's kind of what you've been talking about is for these babies. Many times the parents are gone during the daytime and they're not an animal in need at all. They're just an animal left alone for the time being.
Absolutely. And that behavior of the fawn that you were just describing, that is completely normal for a very young fawn, usually within the first 2 weeks of age. So fawns, when they're little like that, they're just not big enough. They're not strong enough to follow mom around as she's out and about during the day, finding food for herself too. And her presence alone, the scent that she has, those are all things that will attract attention, could attract predators to her young. So the best thing that she does to hide them is to leave him alone during most of the day. She'll come back a couple times a day to feed him, usually early morning and early evening, and they're by themselves. They're curled up like that, hiding the best that they can. And what she'll do is she'll move them from place to place as well. So it's pretty common if you see them laying down in one spot one day, they're going to be gone the next day. So that behavior, again, that you saw laying down like that, we get a lot of questions right now about fawns, but that is absolutely normal behavior. And the best thing you can do, you can observe from a distance, take some pictures from inside if that's safe, if you want to, but give them their space, give them their time, and mom will get reconnected with her fawn.
Even if they're right there in downtown Warrens. And Nancy, thank you so much for the call. I want to ask about what happens if we're responsible for an injured wild animal. And Taylor, for example, if it gets hit by our car or if it's injured by one of our pets, what responsibility do we have there?
Sure. Well, you know, and like you said, sometimes, you know, a common situation is our pets. You know, we're all outside enjoying the warmer weather that we're having. And, you know, sometimes, you know, a common case we come across is a dog or a cat might find a rabbit nest in your yard or garden or somewhere. So just as an example, a case like that, if your pet gets a hold of one, you know, unfortunately being so little, oftentimes they might, you know, end up with some sort of injury. So in that case, you know, you can always, you know, reach out to a local licensed wildlife rehabilitator or even someone with the DNR, and we can, you know, help you out with trying to find somebody who's in your area. That's a lot of, you know, what both I and Mandy do this time of year. You know, we're here to assist and try and help find a place that can assist in those situations. So certainly there are times where they might be in need of help with some sort of injury. And there are also other times where maybe it's an injury they can just, you know, survive on their own. So sometimes, you know, if it's something that's a little less mild, like some sort of road rash or, you know, some sort of cut or injury that's going to heal just fine, sometimes they don't need an intervention. But always good to just check in and always ask, you know, first and get a second opinion as well.
And again, the wildlife rehabilitation resources and directory from our DNR is available online at WPR.org/Central Time. Find the link to today's show and it'll take you right there. Before we get back to our calls at 1-800-642-1234, I want to ask about transporting these animals and what role or responsibility we'd have in getting them to a rehabilitation center or out of a place where it shouldn't be or could be in danger. How do we best move these animals who may be in need? And I don't know if Mandy or Taylor, whoever better, is best to answer that.
Well, sure, I can get us started this time, and if I miss anything, Taylor can fill in the blanks for me. But certainly take some considerations into mind if you do have to handle a wild animal, put it into a safe container, and transport it to a rehabilitator. Usually we recommend having like a pet carrier or a box or some kind of big enough size container, just given the animal, with a towel on the bottom of it, and then safely placing the animal inside, or if you can kind of corral it inside, if that's possible, that's fine too. Of course, you're wearing gloves, you're protecting yourself that way. And then inside a container, it'll have a blanket, it'll have something to grab onto to kind of feel a little bit more secure with. And then keep that container in a quiet, dark, calm place, away from people, away from pets. You want to be not adding any stress to that animal, because it is a stressful situation for everybody. And then contacting a rehabilitator and making some arrangements. Usually you do have to make an appointment to bring an animal to them. So just making some arrangements and then getting the animal to them as quickly as possible. During transport too, just keep things in mind in the vehicle, like nice, good temperatures. It's kind of warm out there, so have it a little cooler in the car. No radios, no talking. Really just trying to keep it as most of a stress-free environment.
I'd have a tendency to want to talk softly to it and coo, and but that would be yep. Probably more harm than good again, right?
Yeah, probably. They're not used to that, so they'll be stressed out.
Mandy Camps, Taylor Siskin from our DNR helping us with how to best help wild animals when we come across them in the outdoors this summer. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234, where Herb joins us now, who's driving. Herb, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I'm curious. I'm traveling a lot this last couple of summers, and once in a while come across a big snapping turtle. Mm. And I'm just trying to figure out if there's anything you need to be prepared about with a big snapping turtle to keep you safe and the turtle safe. And also, my second question is also about deer. Once in a while, you come across a wounded deer from a car accident, and the animal obviously needs to be dispatched. What's a good toolkit to have in one's trunk to be prepared for just about any animal that you might come across on the road?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Let's start with the snapping turtle and what the best way, because I've come across this too, when how does a turtle get to the other side of the road? Sometimes it needs a little bit of a lift. Am I mistaken in that, Mandy or Taylor?
No, you're right. Sometimes, if again, safety first, we're talking about being on a road where there's vehicles and people, so always human safety first. But if you do and you can, if you are in a situation where you can move a turtle off the road, important note here, move it in the direction it's going. It's going there for a reason. So you don't want to turn it around, because if you do, it'll just try to turn right back around and cross the road again. Any smaller turtles, a little bit safer. You generally want to pick them up from kind of the back side or edges of the shell, like painted turtle, for example, and then gently, slowly just walk it to the other side of the road and put it on the other side. With a snapping turtle, that's definitely more of a challenge. They actually have pretty long necks. They can reach around and try and get at the person or the item that or thing that's picking it up. So if you can safely, sometimes you can hold on to the backside, like towards the tail. If you can kind of, if you happen to have like a shovel, sometimes people just have like a winter shovel in their car year round. You can kind of put that underneath the turtle or slide kind of something flatter. If it's not that big of a turtle, you might be okay sliding your hand underneath the backside, but again, the backside and not the sides of that snapping turtle.
And I apologize because we are just out of time, but there is so much more to talk about. And Taylor and Mandy, I want to thank you both for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks again for having us and all the questions that came in.
You bet. Mandy Camps is a wildlife conservation specialist for the DNR. Taylor Siskin is a wildlife rehabilitation specialist at our DNR. Coming up after the news, we hear from one of the UW-Madison scientists involved in the discovery that an ancient human ancestor may have buried its own dead and what that may mean for us humans. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, Homo sapiens were once thought to be the only species that buried its dead. But an international team of scientists, including UW researchers, say they found evidence of graves made by an ancient human ancestor 100,000 years before the first known burials. We'll talk to one of those researchers about his work. But first, some people who worked remotely during the COVID-19 pandemic have returned to the office, and some employers are moving to limit remote work any further. But as Gabby Vinnick reports, in some rural Wisconsin communities, the opportunity to work remotely has given people more freedom.
Are you a good girl?
Yes, you are. You're a good girl, Bee.
On a sunny Friday afternoon, Laura Isaacson's dog, Bee, wants to play. After a few pets for her chocolate lab, Isaacson sits back at her computer at the kitchen table. She's surrounded by bookshelves, and she has light shining through the windows of her home in Mount Horeb. It's a different experience than her time working as a dietitian for the last 20 years. She would often drive to and from the hospital in the dark. Her commute took roughly 30 minutes to Dodgeville. Now, Isaacson works from home as a diabetes care and education specialist for a San Francisco-based company. She's one of more than 400,000 remote workers in Wisconsin.
I am so much happier right now. I don't think I even realized before how stressed out I was. Trying to balance being a mom and working full-time outside of the house.
Isaacson is one of millions of people who first worked remotely during the pandemic. Today, as many as 40% of workers nationally say they do at least some of their work from home. There are signs that some plan to return to the office. In April, a Morning Consult poll found nearly half of U.S. employees prefer working in person. And a Pew Research survey in March found that remote workers tend to say it hurts their opportunities to be mentored. But Isaacson says she has no immediate plans to return to the office, and working from home has given her more flexibility.
That's something I think a lot of moms struggle with. You feel really guilty trying to find that balance. And for me, the flexible schedule, not having a start time or an end time, and just being able to work when it works for me and works for my family, huge difference.
In Mineral Point, Rachel Bergstrom speaks with the client on Zoom from a small room in her farmhouse.
Yeah, Friday afternoons are really flexible for me after 2, so.
She's an education consultant for a Texas-based company. Not long ago, this meeting would have been impossible. She says their Wi-Fi would not have been stable enough to run. But in recent years, millions of federal and state dollars have gone to expanding broadband access in Wisconsin. It now reaches more than 90% of state residents. That infrastructure has helped Bergstrom connect with colleagues all across the country. For her, remote work meant an end to years of leaving her home at 5 a.m. She had to wake up early to catch a ride on the state van pool to her job with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. In all, she spent about 3 hours on the road.
I don't know that I coped with the commute. I think it took a bigger toll on me than I realized now that I have more time to think.
Jose Maria Barrero is a finance professor and co-founder of the nationally recognized Work From Home Research Project. He says a relatively low-cost state like Wisconsin could be a winner in the work-from-home economy.
I think Wisconsin is interesting in that it is a state that has both large urban areas and a lot of rural areas. And so I think it has an opportunity to perhaps decongest the congested parts of the state.
Barrero says if rural areas have greater access to high-income workers, that could be a boon for local economies. But more work from home also means less foot traffic to urban downtowns, which creates its own challenges. Back in Mineral Point, Bergstrom says she hopes remote work possibilities benefit small towns like hers.
Maybe kids will stay in their small towns more because they can find a job programming, or they can find a job in an industry that's really booming, even if there's not a huge company here that does that.
Remote work is already shaping policy in new ways for Wisconsin, and Bergstrom is one of thousands who has no plans to get back to the office. Gabby Vinnick, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, an international group of scientists say they found evidence that an ancient human relative, the species Homo naledi, buried their dead. The archaeological evidence may go back 140 to 240,000 years earlier than the earliest known human burials at Kafsa Cave in Israel. If this is true, it may change what we think we know about the evolution of our species and what it means to be human. What do you want to know about the evolution of our species, Homo sapiens, and how we got where we are today? Do you have questions about the discovery of the Homo naledi species and the discovery of thousands of bones of ancient human ancestors that have been discovered by our next guest? Join us 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. John Hawks is a professor and associate chair of anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a paleontologist helping to lead the fieldwork and analysis of the Rising Star Cave in South Africa, where Homo naledi were first discovered. And John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about this discovery of this species, Homo naledi, and how you came across it.
You know, we first discovered the bones in 2013. They are in a very, very deep part of the cave system that is actually it's accessible to us only through a 12-meter climb, about a 40-foot climb that has areas that are only about 7.5 inches wide. That is incredibly challenging. And our team that work in the cave system, they worked underground and recovered bones that we recognized were not like anything that we'd seen before that's a human relative. And so that was our discovery about 10 years ago. We named the species Homo naledi, and it is actually the largest fossil discovery in any single site in Africa.
How is the Homo naledi different than us, the Homo sapiens?
So Homo naledi lived around the same time as the earliest members of our species, Homo sapiens, between 250,000 and about 330,000 years ago. The species was different. It was similar to us in that it walked upright like we do. It was the size of kind of small statured people. So between about 4'6" and about 5'2" tall. They they walked like us. They were much better at climbing. Their pelvis is a little bit differently shaped than us. Their teeth tell us that they had a pretty high quality diet. They were eating a diet a lot like humans do, but their brains were only a third the size of ours. So they seem to share relationship with us sometime deep in our ancestry, more than a million years ago.
Wow. John, how has this discovery of the Homo naledi changed what we know about human history or the evolution of the genus we belong to?
A couple of really big points. One of them was that, you know, we learned that we weren't alone when we first evolved. You know, people know that humans today have an African origin. This species lived in South Africa at the same time that our species was originating in Africa. Hmm. So, you know, we know that we've got ancient relatives. We didn't expect that we would have one right at the time and place where our species was getting started. And that was a big deal. The other was that this species must have had something going for it in order to survive alongside of other humans and human relatives that had brains that were three times its size. We wondered, what is going on with this species? How is it able to persist in an environment where it's competing potentially with other species that are really, you know, we think are cognitively better? And how did its bones wind up in this mysterious place?
John Hawks, is the hypothesis then that the cognitively bigger might not necessarily have equated to a cognitively better?
You know, what we're finding is that this species was using large parts of this deep cave environment. We found it in different parts of the cave system. In our most recent announcement, we show that at least two of the bodies that we found were placed into holes and covered. So they were buried. And we found engravings in the chamber where we have some of these bodies. And so that evidence combined says that maybe it's not big brains that are really driving some of our at least cognitive social abilities.
Yeah. So if we have evidence now, and if you've uncovered evidence in these caves in South Africa that there was a burial ritual, what does that imply about this species? And then what would you assume, or what could we hypothesize about this species and its society?
You know, I think I look at ourselves, you know, every human culture in the world has some kind of ritual or practice that they do when someone dies. And they're varied. Some cultures, you know, maybe some that we're familiar with, bury bodies, right? And in a very characteristic way. But many of them do other kinds of things. They cremate, they have, you know, expose the body to scavengers sometimes. They put bodies into rivers. You know, there's an amazing diversity of things that people do. But they share something really core, which is that it's a social ritual that enables the entire society to recognize that someone has left and to comfort people who may be really grieving, who are closely connected to the person that's died. And that's something that is actually very core to our being. It's something that we explain to our young children when someone dies. Of course, today we have tremendous, you know, religious ideas that theology that's centered around what happens when people die. But those things are very particular to different cultures. What's shared is that all of us have grieving, all of us have mourning, and as a society, people come together to do something to recognize that they all share it. It's a really powerful statement that there's something about humans that we share that's actually deeper than our species.
Oh, man. John Hawks, our guest, paleontologist and professor and associate chair of anthropology at UW-Madison. We go to your questions now at 1-800-642-1234. Marcus in Milwaukee, you're on the air.
Hi. So my question, Professor, is I've noticed that it seems like different groups, what were previously on the Homo sapien, like our family tree, you have Denisovans, you have Neanderthals, you have Homo naledi, and they're all so Homo floresiensis, and they're all so spread out. It seems like they've almost been put onto like certain parts of the map to keep them separated, like it was a seeding type experiment. And I guess I'd like your thoughts on that. And on burials, wouldn't that indicate that they had belief in God or some sort of afterlife or religion when you start having ritualistic type burials?
Is there a suggestion of the belief system in place there, John?
That's a great question. And I'll just take the second question first. You know, today people all over the world share, they all have some kind of mortuary ritual or funerary ritual. And that is constant in every culture, despite the huge variation they have in religious beliefs. Many cultures in the world don't have a conception of an afterlife. Many of them have, you know, different conceptions. And this element is something that all of them share. So I wouldn't ascribe to any ancient group something very particular to some cultures in the world today. It's something deeper than our religious ideas in a way.
And what about Marcus's yes, go ahead.
Yeah, we have in the last couple of decades just tremendously discovered new things. Some of those discoveries like ours are coming from fossil exploration. Some of them are coming from genetic work. And I'm here in New York right now at a memorial conference, actually, for Richard Leakey. Richard died last year. He was a tremendous explorer and motivated work in Kenya and really was an inspiration to many of us. And what I'm learning here is just how much there is still to discover. You know, we've got fossil hominins in many parts of the world, but the parts that we have a lot of knowledge of are parts that we've worked for a long time. There is a lot of places where our work has only just started. And I think that you're going to see that we're going to begin filling up the map even more than it is already.
How exciting to find out that we still have so much more to find out. We're talking with John Hawks, UW-Madison paleontologist, about his work analyzing the remains of our human ancestor, the Homo naledi, found in the Rising Star Cave in South Africa. It is northwest of Johannesburg, as I understand it. And we'll continue our conversation, maybe hear from you at 1-800-642-1234, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn. And coming up, the local news industry continues to shrink with layoffs and newspapers downsizing or shutting down. We'll talk to one of the organizers of a new coalition that aims to revitalize local journalism. But right now, we're picking up our talk with UW-Madison paleoanthropologist John Hawks about new evidence that the Homo naledi, an ancient species related to us, may have buried their own dead and what that may mean to us. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We'll go to Ben in Sparta next. Ben, you're on the air. Good afternoon.
New evidence that the Homo
Hi, Professor Hawks. I'm interested in what your current thinking is about the relationship. You know, the old idea of the relationship body-brain ratio, total neuronal mass and what we think of as intelligence, but there's been research with other animals, other species, birds, and other species exhibiting behaviors that we previously thought were too complex for the size of their brains. This discovery seems to follow up on that. So if, in fact, it's not the total number of neurons that contributes to intelligence, how does that work, in your opinion?
Interesting. Thank you, Ben. John?
So we've examined the inside surface of the skulls of Homo naledi. We've got some really high detailed evidence there. There's a limited amount that we can say about the organization of ancient brains from the fossil record. The brain is an organ that unfortunately doesn't fossilize, but we can see a few details about its shape from its external surface. That's an imprint on the inside surface of the skull. What we can see between humans and some of our very early hominin relatives is the frontal lobe is organized a little differently today. We've actually expanded parts of the frontal lobe that we today use for organizing language and have expanded parts of the frontal lobe relative to the other parts of the brain. With Homo naledi, see evidence that they had a human-like brain organization, at least in that respect. And that leads us to think that there may be something about the wiring of the brain that matters more than the sheer size of it. But that's not to say that size isn't relevant. You know, I don't know what Homo naledi's behavioral capacities would have been in many aspects. I think that when we look at humans today and think, wow, you know, the brain solves every problem, we actually have to look at a finer resolution. We have to understand that we actually use different solutions for different problems, and that involves different brain tissues, and some problems that maybe we're really good at today are things that our big brain helps with, but some of these aspects that we consider to be deeply human actually might have originated earlier than big brains.
John Hawks, UW-Madison paleoanthropologist, joining us and answering your questions at 1-800-642-1234 about what he and his team have uncovered in the cave systems in South Africa. We'll go to Dennis in Two Rivers next. Dennis, good afternoon.
Hi. I was just thinking as far as, what's really the distinguishing between human and human-like? Because, I think people used to think, it was only humans that would use tools, but then, chimpanzees have been shown to use some like tools, and it would seem kind of using tools to dig a hole to put dead in would be quite an undertaking.
John, part of your discovery seems to have been the suggestion that there may have been a tool buried with one of these Homo naledi. Is that correct?
It's entirely fascinating. In fact, I have news from one of my collaborators this morning. We have one of our burials. When we encountered bone, we removed it from the cave system in a plaster jacket, just like you would do a dinosaur bone to protect it. And our team had to bring it out of the narrow passageway. And once they were able to do that, we put it into a CT scanner and we visualized what was inside. That was how we discovered, really intact parts of a skeleton that were there. And near the hand bones of this skeleton was an artifact, a rock that was elongated, that had a sharp edge. And in the CT scan, we were like, wow, this is amazing. We have left all of this in the plaster jacket. We're not disrupting it in any way. We're using only virtual data for it. But to get better imagery of this rock, we actually had to take the whole thing to France to put in a special scanner that uses a synchrotron radiation to high-energy microtomography. And we have imagery of this rock that is at the nanoscale. We have just amazing images. It's super interesting. It's not really characteristic of stone tools that we recognize by intentional multiple flaking being made, right? This is a very simple object. We don't know for sure that Homo naledi made it, but it is in a super interesting context in a place where we don't have any other rocks and we haven't found any other like this. And it's one of the sort of enigmatic parts of this. As scientists, we're like, okay, what do we do next? And in fact, my team is finding out new things to do with it. So it's going to be fun.
What are some of the arguments against the hypothesis that this is a burial site, that there is evidence that this Homo naledi had to some degree a ritual for the dead and a way to mourn those that are lost?
You know, really, it's complicated when we're looking at ancient artifacts and ancient sites. When we talk about what happened to a body at the time of death today, we're talking about forensic science. You know, we're talking about really, you want as much evidence as possible. The archaeological record degrades that evidence over time. And so as the evidence that we have, we can compare to early human burials, to Neanderthal burials, to other examples that we have, and we can show that a hole was dug here. A body was covered in it. But that's extremely hard to document at the level that a forensic scientist would. And so, we do have archaeologists who are like, yeah, okay, you've shown me that there was a depression in the floor of the cave, but I really want, hard evidence that this was actually buried at the time. We're fortunate that we have two examples, and they both present what we view as very strong evidence. Part of the scientific process is that degree of skepticism. And we have to expect that people are going to say, we thought that this was a human behavior. We really, really want some very, very hard evidence for this. And that's what we do our best to provide.
Could you give us a brief, and I've only got about a minute here, John, explanation of what you are up to next and where your team will be looking to go forward?
We have not only this site, but a number of other sites with other species that we're investigating. But in Rising Star, we are really focused right now on doing a detailed mapping of the cave system with scanning, looking for more cultural evidence. We have to, we have additional pieces of wall that are engraved in parts of the system, and we have to understand what the total system, what's there, to be able to possibly reconstruct something about the culture of this ancient human.
John Hawks, we look forward to talking to you again. So thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
John Hawks is professor and associate chair of anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He talked to us today about his work with remains of ancient human relatives found at the Rising Star Cave in South Africa. Join Kate Archer-Kent for the morning show tomorrow as she finds out what's next for local journalism and hundreds of journalists who have walked off the job, insisting on an end to cost-cutting at the country's biggest newspaper chain. That's tomorrow morning from 7 to 9. Not all superheroes wear spandex. 14-year-old Preston Mutanga was born in Minnesota. His parents are from Cameroon. Preston grew up in Toronto, creating his own comic books and building cars out of Legos. As the New York Times details, last year, Preston recreated his own version of the trailer for the latest superhero movie, Spider-Man: Across the Spider-Verse. Preston posted his movie trailer online, and it was shot for shot a version of the original, except he recreated it in the Lego universe, and it caught the attention of the movie's directors, writers, and producers. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse hit the big screens last Friday, and if you've seen it, you know that it includes a few Lego scenes, and those scenes are the work of 14-year-old Preston Mutanga. So while celluloid superheroes may have to punch and kick and shoot their shot, the real-life superheroes are the ones who are busy building better worlds. This is Central Time.